All right, so welcome once again to the Veef Show. And for anybody listening to me on the Greatest Movie Ever podcast talking about the greatest movie ever, Rotor, I promised a new Veef Show during that. So this would be that show. I am joined once again by Carl of OUA Maniacs.
Hi there, I'm Carl from OUA Maniacs.
And I want to apologize if my voice sounds a little tired. Yesterday I had my first day back at work from the holidays, and our task for the day after bagel duty was removing an entire pallet full of rotten potatoes from the food pantry.
First of all, why did you guys have an entire pallet of potatoes?
Well, it's a food pantry.
That makes sense.
Yeah. You need potatoes. You need food at a food pantry.
I see.
Although lately there has been too much food and not enough pantry.
Mm.
The real question is, why were they both rotten and in the way back? Well, because we often have to rush what we're doing, and we tend to just kind of put things wherever.
Yeah. I guess it is surprising that potatoes are a very hearty vegetable, so the fact that they rotted says a lot, I think.
They got some moisture in them, which I tried to just move like the individual bags, but one just broke open and it smelled even worse. Yeah, so we certainly dragged that thing outside to throw it out. Anyways, we're not talking about potatoes, although we certainly could. We're not talking about the first episode of Matt Cross Delta either. Have you seen that?
I actually did watch it just a couple days ago, actually.
What did you think?
It was cool. I mean, it was cool. I'm interested in seeing where it goes. It has a very coarse AKB's 0048 feel, 0048.
I like my friend D-Kun's assessment of the series, where he spoke out against the constant comparisons to Precure, and he said, no, Precure is way more manly.
Wait, people are comparing it to Precure?
People don't know. They don't understand the new animes. There's a lot of old fogies who were just grasping at straws.
I'm surprised they watched Precure. I guess Precure at this point is actually an old fogey anime because it came out in 2003, 2004.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, okay, because we're talking about Aquarion Logos, which is in fact the 10th anniversary project for the Aquarion series, which strangely it also is 10 years old now, it was last year.
Yeah, that's actually kind of crazy to think about. I was let me tell you about my first memory, my first experience with Aquarion in general, was that I was actually studying abroad in Japan at the time, and fortunately I had a TV, and just woke up in the middle of the night and just watched this crazy show with these mecha, and I think I saw the first episode I saw was with the Moon Surface Punch.
Oh, okay.
And it was just like, what is going on with the series? It's so bizarre. And also, of course, the show. Of course, the series is known for very strong music. But anyway, the Aquarion Logos, it's weird because it's not a show I guess I expected people or even the company itself to want to celebrate that much. It always feels like Aquarion is that show that people don't talk about or watch or even aware of.
It's a very second tier series or even third tier. It just sort of comes out to, I guess, I don't know, give the company that's Sankyo, who owns Satellite, another anime property to make into a pachinko game. And it's also especially very strange because Aquarion Logos had basically very little merchandising support. Or at least traditional mecha anime merchandising support. There has yet to be any toys of the main robot announced. And also an interesting thing is that Shoji Kawamori, despite being Aquarion creator and vision creator that he is, did not work on this Aquarion series.
Yeah, I think it really shows. I didn't look too deep into it, but just even the mecha designs alone did not feel Kawamori at all. But it's kind of leading into the toy thing. It may be that was for its benefit because the mecha designs in Aquarion Logos are not very toy friendly, in my opinion. They mess up. Basically, they are very dynamic and they're kind of designed to be very sleek and stylish. but not in the way that you typically expect from something that can be transformed into a $100 action figure.
Yeah, well, it's weird because the Aquera and Evol design, they only made a non-transforming action figure of it, the Super Robot Shugoken. And I would think that, well, they would do a non-transforming figure of the main Aquarion form, or at least the one that's on the key images. I can't even remember what it's called, because I just know it's the red, the one with the red top and blue bottom.
Yeah, like there's so many names for the Aquarions, and it's even more than the other shows.
Yeah,
that it's hard to keep track of.
It's basically Twin ZMV Plasma Formation. And Twin ZMV from Techromancer or Kikaio was actually designed by Shoji Kawamori, so it's kind of funny. And also, like, one of the things with this Aquarion series is rather than going for the full Getarobo thing where there's three robots that arrange into three different forms, there are multiple the ships or the vectors, as they're called. And they can combine in different ways, usually in two-ship formations, but sometimes in three or four. Or even all of them can combine together. So, and I have to agree, they are very, not as toy-friendly. There's a lot of, like, tiny panels that move, and they seem to cheat a little bit more than with the other Aquarion series. And I believe the designer for it, I'm not sure, they haven't listed specifically Aquarion designer, but it might have been either Sachio Ikeda, or Stan, or I don't know how to pronounce this. Is a French name.
I think it's Stanislas.
Stanislas Brunet.
Brunet, I know. Stanislas sounds more like a Russian name or something, but probably whatever. Anyway.
Well, he worked on Oban Star Racer, so I assume he's a French man.
I guess we should probably get to the story at some point, but focusing on the mecha design a bit more, just because this is the V show. The design of the Aquarion, the vectors and whatnot, and other combined forms, feels very... I guess it's one of those things where it doesn't feel like it comes from, like, a traditional Japanese anime mecha aesthetic. Like, there's something else in there. Maybe close to what you said about Oban Star Racers. Did Stanislas work on Gyrosetter as well? I think I recall seeing that name, but I might be unsure.
I can check. I know Kawamori worked on... Gyrosetter.
He made the Not Near Vash or whatever.
He is listed, as part of Satellite.
Okay.
So he probably did one of the random designs.
Yeah. The 5 million ones. It's just like in general though, like even like I think like the mecha design or it's mecha design themselves are representative of just how different Aquarion Locos is a series, even compared to previous Aquarion series. It's like Aquarion was pretty weird. Aquarion Evol was considered arguably more weird or less weird, but maybe it appealed more to it caught the attention of more English speaking fans. But Aquarion Logos is just so far out there in terms of character design, in terms of mecha design, in terms of story that it's unique, special, one might say,
an especially unique series from. Yeah. Satellite, who seems to make a lot of very hard to pin down shows. The basic story is 12,000 years ago, mankind was so in tuned with the very words that kind of made up life, the universe, and everything that they could literally command things to happen just by uttering a word. Basically, being in touch with language in the purest sense. But they wanted to preserve, their memories and their history, so they had created writing. And this had caused a rift between... and I'm getting in kind of some of the backstory stuff, but this is all set up anyway. Between, one tribe that was for just, speaking, using their so-called verbalism ability, and those who just wanted to use their writing to preserve their world. And we kind of flash forward to what is probably the least fantastical of the Aquarion universes. Mm. It's just sort of Asagaya, Japan. pretty much modern-day Japan, with people who are just modern-day Japanese anime citizens. And there's some weird stuff happening, because there's a guy, a businessman in a robe, throwing... hypodermic needles at the physical manifestations of words and corrupting them, turning into what are called mojibake.
Essentially word monsters.
Yeah, word monsters, which I believe the term is actually used for like garbage text, like encoding.
That makes sense.
So, yeah. An example, like the first mojibake they face, it is the one for twisting.
Yeah,
maki. And it causes lots of things to like twist around in unnatural ways, like an entire like monorail system would twist itself, or parts of a tower or something would just like become this terrible thing, and there'd be like windstorms and all that. And you know, the whole goal of this evil businessman, Sōgon Kenzaki, is to bring mankind back in touch with words in the way by destroying what was called the Logos world. And this is the world of writing, basically what separates mankind from the direct power to like control the world using just their words.
Yeah, I think this overall, the story is pretty understandable, especially because nowadays a lot of people criticize, you know, people who are on the internet too much, people only text instead of talk on the phone. The idea is that, you know, like if you don't speak to someone in person, you can't truly understand their feelings, or you can't truly get what they mean. Like there is the idea of what Kenzaki Sōgon is fighting against, why he wants to destroy the world, essentially, is because he feels like words have lost all meaning in society, and we need to get back to how they were originally. Like, there's even this, it reminds me of this, if you ever read this comic called, what's the word? Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. There's this one panel where someone's telling another person who's writing, he says, you know, stop that writing. If you write too much, you won't be able to use your memory. And it has essentially that same feeling of why, like, essentially, we have become lazy and disconnected from the world through our over-reliance on written records and text.
Hmm.
There's one other thing I wanted to say. It was that, actually two other things. One is that the series is very heavy on the use of like kanji, and it might be one of those things where maybe Japanese is especially suited for a series like this, because for example, you know, in English, right, to some extent, if you had a word like run, which has like, I don't know, like 65 meanings or whatever, we could have a similar thing. Like you take the word run, it could mean like run for president. It can mean to, you know, move quickly. It can mean your nose can run. Mm-hmm. And Aquarian Logos does the same thing with words. Like the same word that means twist is even the word used to say like volume in like volume 1, volume 2, volume 3. So during the episode, someone's discussing with their friends on their phone, like, oh, did you check up volume 5 or whatever of, I think it was called Macross or something like that. They made some sort of Macross reference in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple of Macross references in it.
And the word volume just like disappears. Like essentially like, they're like, volume, what's a volume? Like that idea no longer exists to me. And that's kind of the interesting, weird, like it's a very unconventional adversary for mecha show, or even a show in general. Like, how do you, unless you're like Bakemonogatari or something, it's like, how do you fight a word? How do you fight the corruption of meaning? Like, it's very strange, but also, of course, I think in a way, even though it's quite different from other Aquarian series, also very much in line, because Aquarian as a whole, though not to the extent that it does in this series, has always loved to play around with words. Though I actually remember the last thing I want to say, and just only a side tangent, it's that, you know, we talked about how Sōgon throws those like needles, those darts at the wall, and it corrupts like one of the words.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, have you seen on Twitter recently, like the past couple of days, there's been this little vine going around about like this like Dutch darts champion.
Oh yeah, I just saw that today.
And he throws it, and then he throws it, and he raises his hands up, and this like background scene just erupts. It just makes me think of that now.
I just kind of liked it because it was like that one piece of stock footage from the series that didn't look terribly good, but it's just like they kept using it.
The characters, like the main, probably the thing I think that might make or break this series in terms of people's willingness to watch it is how much you like the main character. And it's not one of those things where, like, in other shows where he's like, oh, he's like a scoundrel, or he's like, you know, the guy you love to hate. He's just a really eccentric person.
I was gonna say Akira, he's I want to say he's somewhere between Amata from Aquarion Evol and Apollo from the original Aquarion, mm-hmm. as far as like weirdness, you know, because Amata, despite having wings in his feet, he was a pretty down-to-earth guy.
Yeah,
you know, and Apollo is a wolf boy, so you kind of like know these two extremes because they're very clearly defined. Mm-hmm. Akira is what looks like, you know, a normal high school student in Japan, but he's obsessed with being a savior and saving people, and also calligraphy. So, which is not the easiest thing to get American audiences into.
I don't know. When I was a kid, I was like, man, calligraphy is so awesome. I mean, English calligraphy. I was like, man, I really want to. I never got good at it.
Oh, okay.
But it just always looked so awesome. Anyway, the Akira, like, he literally has a savior complex. Like, it's hard to describe. It's one of those things where he is, like, very intentionally, at least up until the end, around the end, a very one-note character. Like, you ask him, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? A savior. Like, what do you want to do today? Save people. Like, why did you eat that sandwich? It's going to make me better at saving. Like, he is so... It basically is his driving force, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the sense that he literally uses a term that... He uses the term savior that is used in Japanese that describes, like, Kenshiro, like, a savior. He's not just someone who, like, rescues people. He feels like he should be a savior. He should be someone who, like redeems and, like, essentially makes the world right.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not you think that makes him the most annoying character ever or this really bizarre, like, you know, a lot of people are just like, I need to empathize with main characters. And the rest of the cast is very, I think, to varying degrees, are pretty easy to empathize with. I think that they're a pretty interesting bunch. But Akira, as the main character, you have to kind of be willing to accept this bizarre guy whose, like, thoughts are kind of obtuse as your protagonist.
Well, he's similar to Basara from Macross 7. Mm,
that's true,
actually. But he's even kind of more... I guess he's less, you know, boisterous and some would say obnoxious. Mm. But still, he's even stranger in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There's something about that, like, the subtle obtuseness that is just kind of maybe even more harder to grasp.
The rest of the cast, I think, it really helps liven up the show. I mean, the whole what I find really interesting about the show and the main cast, the main heroes, is that they are all part of a group called D.Va, and they're there. They've been founded to fight the Mojibake, and their whole thing is that they are, on the surface, they're this weird, like, not a maid cafe, some sort of weird, like, otaku cafe, where they are the employees and they can... They role play in front of the audience.
Yeah, they put on plays mostly.
Yeah, and their whole thing is that each character has some connection with words. Like, this is why they're part of the club. They essentially all of them have this verbalism ability. They are able to take their spoken words and transform them into reality to certain degrees. And each of them has a different connection to words. Like, one character is an aspiring politician. He believes in words having the power to, like, you know, change government and change society.
Hayato, the Debbie Downer of the group.
Yeah. Oh, there's a little girl who wants to be an actor and actress. You know, that's an obvious one. There is I forget what his name, the comedian, the YouTube comedian.
Oh yeah, that's Domon.
Yeah, he wants to use the power words to make people laugh. He wants to just, like, be the ultimate YouTube celebrity, which is a really weird ambition. Well,
it reminds me, I'm probably getting the show title mixed up, but what's that cartoon with the bluebird and the beaver?
The normal show, I think it was. Regular show, that was it.
Yeah, because I was watching I was at a friend's house, and I saw an episode of it, and they were competing with some other kid to be, like, the best YouTube celebrity ever. Mm. And it seems so weird to me, like, huh, yeah, I guess this is what kids' shows would be about these days. And you know, Domo kind of reminded me of that.
Oh, yeah. It's important to remember that Domo is not a successful YouTube star.
No. He has one fan, at least.
Yeah. I love that episode. And then probably the two most important ones are, I need to look up their names. So
Kokone, the other girl.
Yeah.
And Maya.
Okay, Kokone, who is this, she's basically a super quiet girl who you wonder why she's part of it. And it's because, like, basically she has an extremely powerful verbalism ability, but she's afraid to use it. She's very, like, a shy character, like, very low tone of voice. And the other one is Tsukigane Maya, who is an enemy on the other side. Like, she is a loyal agent of Kenzaki Sogon, and she has a similar power, and essentially, I don't want to spoil too much, but, like, she gets roped into the workings of the main characters.
She's also kind of our Centrati or Meltrandi of the series, because she was raised from birth to be a fighter, to help Sogon's son, Subete, use their own Aquarion to sort of change the world and destroy the Logos world.
One of the funnier moments in the series is, I was impressed they actually, like, kept the joke running without wearing it out too much, was that she is so unaccustomed to, like, even semi-normal life, that when she first encounters the cleaning ladies of the Aquarian Logos team, like, of D.Va, she thinks they're all, like, secret agents who are,
she thinks that they're the powerful guardians of the base.
Yeah, they're, like, the last line of defense, and she, like, it's just really funny, because in later episodes she'll just, like, randomly be like, oh, like, where'd you find out about that? Oh, the
cleaning team.
She calls them something absurd, like the ultimate defense or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it just works really well. Like, she does have kind of a, what's her name? Like, Amelia from Macross feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she doesn't understand the culture of humans. Although she is pretty easy at adapting to, like, regular clothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's definitely probably one of the more popular characters of the team. Mm. Although I would say that my personal favorite is team leader, Sakuraku Soda.
Oh, you mean the president? You mean, like, the leader of D.Va?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and because we first see her, she's, like, this cosplaying lady, and she sort of represents the audience watching this show. That is to say, women in their, you know, late 20s and early 30s who love anime and love to dress up and like to be cute, but, you know, also sort of have to clean themselves up and be, you know, serious from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
And there, of course, because this is, you know, a Japanese show, there are many jokes about how she should act her age.
I did appreciate her as a character a lot, just because, it's one of those things that is indeed like a very real thing that people have to go through in Japan, and to some extent, say, in the US as well. Like, you can't, you know, even though you're an adult, even though you want to act a certain way, you can't necessarily do that because it's not expected of you. Mm-hmm. But she's able to. She's both a serious character and a sort of comic relief character, and basically I like her in both roles.
Mm-hmm.
To go back a bit, I just remember, like, when Aquarian Evol first came out, everyone was like, holy crap, Aquarian Evol, like, this show is so amazing, like, what is this, right? And it was like, what? Like, where did you guys come from? Like Aquarian didn't really get that much attention. Of course,
yeah.
It'd been like 5 years, so yeah. You know, it's not that surprising, I guess. And Aquarian Logos, like, it takes it, I think, like, a step further in terms of the way it plays with ideas, the way it essentially, actually, the reason that I'm saying all this is because I was just thinking about some of the resolutions to episodes, like in Aquarian. When they're fighting Word, you know, there'll be a problem. They'll, like, fight through it. They'll ultimately come to a conclusion. That conclusion usually somehow in the form of a bad pun or a good pun, depending on who you are.
And usually it's because somebody found a good way to use their superpowers.
Yeah,
more or less.
But this one, it's all focused. Like, the pun is almost the entire point. Like, that's the resolutions. It's the characters, like, figuring out what their words, what their verbalism, what their ability to convey ideas through written or, you know, writing or speaking, what that can do to transform something. In fact, like the way that a lot of times the characters fight, and it's really kind of strange to look at, is that essentially in Japanese, like most characters are consist of what are called radicals, like little bits and pieces of other things that which come together and form a single letter or single kanji or ideogram. Mm-hmm. And the characters take bits and pieces of them and mash them together to form new words to fight. And it's, and between that and the fact that like the solutions to, say, defeating the villains often comes from individual characters like realizing something about themselves and how they use words. Mm-hmm. Is, I think, it's quite interesting, though. Again, this show is so bizarre in a certain way. I think that because of its aesthetic, because it has that otaku, like a very intentional otaku-ish feel, in terms of like the characters themselves. I need to clarify this: not otaku in terms of pandering, but otaku in terms of why these characters are otaku. There's a constant presence of otaku in the series. That it might not have the impact that it would for a lot of people if it were done in a more serious show, or maybe even like something like Bakemonogatari, again, which is a very similar show in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what really like codifies the very strange approach to it is when they're fighting the insect Mochibake, and the way they ultimately defeat it is through traditional Japanese comedy.
Oh yeah, that was a really good one. That was a Domon focus episode. He basically has to kind of confront why he's been doing YouTube videos, essentially. Like, what is his reason behind wanting to be a YouTube celebrity? It's a very important thing. Like, there's another episode that reminds me of where essentially the thing that gets him to defeat the enemy is one guy admitting that he himself, he is a pervert, that, like, you know, as prim and proper as he is, you know, it's the Hayato, the politician guy, like, he always has to put on this, like, even though he's really strong in honesty, he also believes in like decency, and he never allows himself to kind of, you know, be controlled by his base desires. But in that one moment when he screams his favorite fetish, like, that is what ultimately empowers Aquarion to defeat the Mochibake. And it's just like, yes, this is pretty much what I wanted out of Aquarion, but with a little twist, because I think Hayato, in fact, is actually a pretty interesting character. Like, his whole thing where, like, you kind of feel for him because he's someone who you can almost say is like in a losing battle. He believes that politics are about, you know, like being a politician should be about using words to convince people and, you know, convincing them of the truth and not mincing words. Like, if people were fully aware of all the stakes at hand, they would
kind of grasp the gravity of the situation.
Yeah, but then most people don't. Like, it was that one, it's a, like, what was that? It was some dumb Simpsons joke, right? Of course, all Simpsons jokes are actually awesome. Is that one where I think Mayor Quimby is, like, running for election, and he says something like, you know, like, I think maybe the topic would have been, like, abortion or whatever, but essentially, like, he, realizing how divisive the crowd is, he basically like says something like, you know, this pandering thing for you guys, this pandering thing for you other guys, and the entire audience cheers. And essentially, that's what he's fighting against. He's fighting against that, like,
abortions for some, no abortions for others.
Yeah, that was it. The audience, like, essentially the public isn't smart enough to be on his like level, and he's like frustrated by the idea. In a way, he's almost like idealistic, that he believes that all people, you know, are capable of this like greater abstract thinking.
Well, it's interesting because in another episode, I want to just mention real quick that episode with the his fetish, that's the beach episode.
Yeah,
where they've managed to almost freeze to death.
Oh yeah,
in a very Macro 7 way. But it's interesting because Hayato is like a very like political like idealist, but also like a very dour realist. Probably one of my favorite episodes of the series, which was also one of the weirdest looking. Like, you could feel just the budget crunch in this episode. The one about nostalgia.
Oh yeah, that was a really good episode.
Wow. Yeah, where you have basically a bunch of adults running around trying to recapture their youth in various ways. And given the time frame of the series, a lot of them were in kind of 80s costumes, you know, lots of pompadours, some rockabilly,
and a lot of like outdated like slang, like etchy, sketchy, one touchy.
Yeah. Yeah. Things that are just kind of lost upon the American audience. But, also the fact that I love how they went around, and they could actually affect words in the real world in this episode. They had kind of just that idea of using what they called the Aquari pen, which is just a little high-tech calligraphy pen for drawing words in real life and giving them power. But the team is dressed up as the Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
Which I have to admit, I am not a huge fan of Ghostbusters. I've never really even seen the first movie in full. I saw the second movie a lot more because they would run that one.
Is that the experience of like when you were a kid and you only watch movies when they air on like Saturday afternoons and such?
Yeah. And it's weird for me. I see my friends and they're all into, you know, Ghostbusters, and like there's a whole lot of just like incredible passion for it. And I'm just like, yeah, it was pretty good. Just seeing the Aquarion team use that in their episode about misplaced nostalgia, I'm not sure if they're going for if that's, you know, if they're like, oh, you know, this is the good nostalgia, or it's like, oh, this is just as bad, but, you know, it's like, eh, it could be.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it could be either way.
I wonder if that's the influence of, like, the French staff on Satellite, because I don't know if Japan has this close connection to Ghostbusters. I mean, personally, like, I never had a close connection to Ghostbusters myself. I think I watched more of the cartoon than I ever did the movies.
Yeah, I watched a bit of the cartoon, but I never got into it as much as, you know, Transformers.
Yeah. I was the same way. Like, basically, my memories of childhood were just, like, I want the shows with, like, the fighting characters. Like, where's my He-Man, the new adventures, and whatnot. The nostalgia episode is just, like, I feel like that's the sort of thing where I feel like maybe if you showed individual episodes to people, like, they'd appreciate it more. Like, you had to show, it's almost like you had to show the right episode to the right person for them to get the show. Otherwise, it just comes across as very strange.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there is several threads running through it, but it is very episodic. And in true, like, J9 series fashion, they have robot fights usually at the end of the episode. Yeah, it's like, oh, the robot stuff isn't really that important, but, you know. And in a way, the show is a bit, I don't want to say cheap, but it kind of is.
Oh, yeah, like the character designs on top of that, like, it's one of those things where they don't lend themselves that well to cheap budgets, just because, like, if they're drawn wrong, they almost look like their faces are melting off.
Yeah, they have sort of like very long, like tapered chins, and very kind of but the girls especially, they have very like fluffy hair, and, you know, kind of like a weird, almost like out of time quality for a late 2000s anime, or 2010s anime, I should say. And also the fact that it takes place in, you know, modern Japan, where in several scenes I was told they're clearly just photographing things that are around the satellite offices to use for backgrounds.
Actually, looking at this, I'm just looking at the thing real quick, just because it's like the staff for Aquarion Logos, and the character designer for it, whose name is Mamezuka Takashi. Mm-hmm. I think this might be perhaps his first work where he is character designing, like, without any sort of, like, existing source material. Because, mm-hmm. Which might describe, because I've never seen character designs quite like the ones are in this series. Like, they're not, like, super crazy. They're not, like, off the wall. But you look at them and you think, like, they don't quite look like what you'd typically expect. They're just different enough that it's really noticeable. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be why, like, it's just, I don't know, like, what the production process was, but it feels like he was given the chance to do whatever he wants, or, like, kind of do things his way, and the result is that you have a pretty interesting bunch.
Hmm. I one of my friends, Richard of the Macross Speaker Podcast, he was helping at the satellite booth at Anime Expo last year, and I think he was talking to one of the women from Satellite who was a producer of the show. He didn't quite get into it too much, but he actually had been recently watching the Aquarion series to kind of get through the satellite catalog and understand better where like Macross Delta is coming from. So it's interesting because the show seemed to be more geared. I don't want to say you know women don't like robot stuff, but more it for like otaku women watching it. Just things about it seemed more like appealing, less. Well, I guess. What do I know? Just like more like, oh, you know, the girls all have like pretty down to earth outfits that are, you know, fashionable and attractive. And, you know, it's all about kind of them doing stuff. And you have like a female character as the boss in charge. And she's, again, representing like the older otaku women who watch anime still. And, you know.
That's interesting. It's interesting because, like, I would not have picked this as a show for girls, but I would not have picked this as a show for guys either. It's just so, like, it doesn't follow along. It just doesn't feel like it falls along those traditional lines in the sense that, like, even now, like, even if you want to show that you make it appeal to guys, make it appeal to girls, usually, you know, emphasize certain things. Like, I'm never entirely sure what the show is emphasizing, so to speak. Like,
yeah, it is kind of just like a bit of... It's a bit of everything, but not in a way that just seems... Not in a way that seems like a mess, just in a way that seems like it's very aware of the world it exists in.
It's like a very intentional mess, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I am curious about that. One thing is that you said, like, so you basically, you have it from fairly good authority that the show was more aimed towards a female audience?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just kind of guessing because that's what I've seen the reaction from like them doing events in Japan and the cosplay out there.
I see. Okay. I mean, that's better evidence than I have. My evidence was like, I was like, oh, hey, let's go on like Pixiv. Let's go on like some art sites, you know, image boards. Let's look up Aquarian logos, like fan art. And there's like three pictures, like five, and half of them are the little girl. So
yeah.
Like you're just like, actually, speaking of that, one thing that's good is that the show, I mean, in the past, like, Aquarian was known for its literally orgasmic combination sequences where characters, like, fly, like, naked and are spiritually and physically naked, and they combine together, and they have, like, what described as, like, the most thrilling rush of their lives and something that feels so unbelievably good, even though it's so wrong. And they do it less often in the series. Like, they do it much less often, and it... when they do, it's usually at like some sort of like critical juncture. The reason I mention this is because I think people may be worried that you have this like, what, she's like 7 years old or something like that.
Yeah,
and you're like, are they gonna do that? But they just like, whether or not they just skip past it entirely. They're just like, whoop. There's like moments. It's just like, kind of like, let's combine. It's almost like at the bottom, it's like moments later, and they're already piloting the robot. So I think there's no need to worry that you're going to be watching a creepy show.
Yeah, they do kind of knowingly not get creepy, but they do have Hayato pair up with Karin, who's the little girl.
Yeah.
And she calls him Oni-chan a lot.
Yeah. So I remember there was also that episode because she's an aspiring child actor. Basically, she is essentially talking to this like entertainment executive bigwig kind of guy, and he's clearly like creeping on her, but she has to deal with the fact that she, in order to further the career, she still has to play the cute innocent girl, even though she clearly knows what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh yeah, like this is the entertainment business.
Yeah, it's interesting, I guess, the way they put the different characters together. I did like how she always has a Pico Pico hammer.
Oh yeah,
for hitting people with. Because you know, even mainly giant robots like Gao Gaigar have one. Anyway, I don't know. I think this is another show where it's kind of hard to talk without revealing spoilers, but it's yeah. It's interesting as it goes along. I would definitely recommend it. I recommend this show a lot more easily than I would like M3 The Dark Metal.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like it has a better chance of like connecting with you in some way, especially if you are interested in the idea of like the corruption word, no matter which side you're on. If you're on the side of like, yeah, them kids and their text messages, or if you're not, you're like, you know, internet, you know, talking on Facebook is the future, get with it, old man.
Yeah.
Actually, I had a question for you, I think, before we head off. I'm curious as to, I mean, you talked to a lot of, like, Mecha fans, a lot of Macross fans. Like, did they watch the series? Did they have any opinions on it? Like you said, like, your friend was catching up on Aquarion in order to understand, like, Satellite as they are.
I did get an impression from Renato of the Macross Speaker podcast, because he was watching the show. He said it was just okay. He said that unlike the previous series, it didn't quite have as many big memorable moments. Because, you know, the previous shows, they had robots punching all the way to the moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some of that in this Aquarion, but I think the fact that all the fights take place, or most of them do, in the Logos world, which is separate from our world, it means the stakes are kind of separated from, like, real life. But even though it's like they have to stop the Mojibake, or a word will be erased and dire things will happen.
Yeah, it doesn't have that immediate impact that occurs. It kind of reminds me of, like, I was listening to an Anime World Order's review of Kuroko's Basketball, and then talking about the difference between, like, a sports anime, which is much easier, much more intuitive, versus something that's really abstract, like Mahjong, and essentially the stakes of winning and losing, and what winning and losing even means. I think it's probably a similar thing here. Like, I probably agree with that. I feel like the show doesn't quite have that kind of strong impact, but it is a unique show that is worth checking out, just because, like, especially they say, like, I think that, like, I keep on comparing to the Monogatari series, and that series, I think, has a lot of fans, but also it kind of can turn people off, because it has this really weird, like heavy perverted vibe, very intentional. Like, the main character is, like, a noble pervert, essentially, and it revels in. It's a very talky show, right? Aquarian Logos is actually not that talky of a show. It's more show rather than tell, but with plenty of telling, just because it's so focused on words and such. Like, it's almost like by talking, they're also showing in the process, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I recommend it as well.
Well, I won't spoil this part. I was thinking about talking about Hayato as the ultimate realist, but...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's just say he doesn't always believe that, you know, just because you try hard that you can accomplish your dreams.
Oh, yeah.
He is firmly into the idea that people are born with certain abilities and, you know, hard work cannot overcome limitations of the harsh reality. Anyway, this has been Andrew for The Veef Show. I want to say CollectionDX.com because I've been doing so many other podcasts.
Oh, yeah. Oh, what have you been doing? I should just mention it to everyone. Because you said it's been a while since you podcasted, right? So,
Yeah, because I've been mostly working on the main website stuff. I did, again, on Paul Chapman's Greatest Movie Ever podcast, we talked about the Terminator exploitation movie Rotor, which is about, you know, a killer robot cop in Dallas, Texas. I have not done really much else other than stuff on the website. If you like my giant robot reviews, I just put up one of the giantest of giant robots, the recent Unite Warriors Devastator, who is an 18-inch tall transformer. And other stuff like that. And I guess I'll plug my my Facebook group to Robits. All you really need to know about Robits is it's spelled Robits. This is a closed group, so I have to approve you. What you need to know about it is look at the title image of the group, which is Atago from Konkole with Rodimus from Transformers, and ask yourself, are you okay with either of these things? If you are, then you're fine for Robits.
I haven't actually posted Robits in a while, just because I think I tend to forget about Facebook, but maybe I should check it out again. I always enjoyed the discussion there. As for myself, I recently appeared on Verse Thieves, podcasting with Alan about Glitter Force, which is everyone's favorite new show, the Netflix original show Glitter Force. It's actually a 90s style dub of Smile Precure, like from the big Precure franchise, like done by Saban, and essentially Power Rangers up. You know, if you miss the era of dubs where they called, you know, onigiri donuts, and and when they go to a city in Japan, they call it the Asia Pacific Expo. Then Glitter Force is for you. But to be fair, that show is, you know, it's a lot of its strengths still stand out, even if its dub is a little bizarre. I also
It's no Mew Mew Power.
Yeah, I also picked my top characters of the year 2015. Recently, go to Ogiomaniacs, OGIUEMANIAX.com to check it out, and stick around to read any other articles you like. I haven't been on very many podcasts lately, I guess, which is why I'm here. So,
fair enough. All right, we are signing off on this amazing V-show and reminding you all that words can hurt.
Literally.
Literally.